This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the metaversal mind chamber where you, me, the top experts and a big subject collide and then resolve for 28 minutes. An AI revolution isn't coming. It's upon us, thanks to huge technological advances in recent years. With change comes a plethora of opportunities. But we've all seen the films where computers become more powerful than humans. And that doesn't normally end well for us. So, how cautious should we be, and what happens next? Of course, you understand what AI is, don't you? How it works and why it's suddenly become the great existential issue of our times? Why, at the end of last month, a letter signed by hundreds of researchers, academics, and even tech entrepreneurs called for a six-month moratorium on the development and the release of new powerful AI tools. No? Me neither. Step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. To help me and you negotiate this new world, its opportunities and dangers, we have with us Professor Michael Waldridge, Director of Foundational AI at the Alan Turing Institute, Nina Schick, author, entrepreneur and advisor specialising in generative AI, and Dr. Anders Sandberg, a Senior Research Fellow at the Future of Humanity Institute. Mike Waldridge, before we get into the complexities, can you just explain to the layperson what is generative AI?
Well, we're starting with the hard questions, I have to tell you. Let's start with what AI is. AI is a research field that's been active for around about 70 years. It goes back to the great Alan Turing in the middle of the last century. And despite 70 years of work, there isn't really any agreement on exactly what AI is. There are a wide range of views. And at one end of the AI spectrum, there are people who are trying to achieve what you might call general AI. And general AI, roughly speaking, is the idea that what we're trying to do is construct artificial entities that have the full range of capabilities that a human being would have. That is, if we succeeded with general AI, then a computer could do anything that a human being could do. But for me, mostly what AI is about getting computers to do things which currently require human beings, require human brains, human nervous systems, and potentially human bodies. And one of the fascinating things about AI is that lots of the things that people completely take for granted and don't even think of as requiring intelligence turn out to be incredibly hard for computers to do. So one of those is doing exactly what we're doing now, having a conversation, just communicating in ordinary language. We don't remember learning language about how to communicate by and large. It's something that we pick up as we grow up. We just take it for granted. But getting computers to do that turned out to be tremendously difficult. And then one of the ironies is there are some things that we find incredibly hard that are really, really, really easy for computers to do. So doing mathematics reliably and very, very quickly. Most people find that really quite hard to do. But for computers, it's not terribly hard to do. So in AI, mostly what we're trying to do is identify the things, those things that, you know, people by and large take for granted, but that are terribly difficult for computers to do. So communicating in natural languages, that is the classic example. Driving a car, riding a bicycle, we don't think of those things as requiring intelligence, but getting computers to do them is very hard.
Now, Nina Schick, a lot of the conversation right now is around this program, ChatGPT, but I don't think people really, a lot of people understand what it is and how it's put together. Can you just give us the heads up on that one?
Yeah. And to answer that question, I'm just going to back up because as Mike already correctly pointed out, AI is kind of the research or the science of trying to give machines human levels of intelligence, right? Or even beyond human levels of intelligence. And a new field of artificial intelligence, which has been about possible for the last 10 years or so, so-called generative AI, is about AI actually creating or generating new data. And these models, so-called generative models, in part include so-called large language models. And these are models that can generate, interpret, analyze text. And ChatGPT is one such application of a so-called LLM. Now, these LLMs were really pioneered in about 2017, thanks to lots of research breakthroughs in the last decade. But it was OpenAI, the kind of company that started as a nonprofit in San Francisco, that decided barely 4 months ago to release ChatGPT to the world. And this has been a phenomenon. Why? Because it is the most popular application in the history of the world. The next closest things in terms of popularity is TikTok. It took TikTok 10 months to get to 100 million users. It took ChatGPT 2 months. And in part, because it seems almost omnipotent, it almost seems godlike that you can interact with an AI system in this way, where you can ask it from a text prompt to write a script, to interpret text, to analyze your notes, and it can do so within seconds.
And Sandberg, because we're talking about the here and now at this moment, I just want to ask you about something which we're going to come back to in more detail later, which was this letter signed last month by the likes of Elon Musk and prominent scientists, essentially calling for a moratorium. Tell us a little bit about that letter and what it said.
So the letter was originated by the Future of Life Institute, which is a network concerned with the long-term future of humanity. And they have for a long while been rather concerned about the rapid AI development, because just like our own work at my institute in Oxford, the Future of Humanity Institute, there are some potential risks and problems with powerful AI systems. So this letter, signed by Elon Musk and a lot of AI researchers and other academics, essentially said, let's try to stop for 6 months of training even bigger models. We still have plenty to do with the current models. We're still discovering amazing things, even from the versions we already have. But maybe we need to actually think carefully about where we're going with this technology before just jumping headlong into this.
Right.
And of course, that led to a lot of reactions. Some people thinking, oh no, you're Luddites. You're really trying to stop technological progress, which is a weird thing to call out Elon Musk about. On the other hand, others say, you're looking at the wrong kinds of problems here. These are futuristic problems, not the actual problems we have. And of course, many companies would say, yeah, that moratorium might be bad for business. So there is a lot of discussion. If the goal was to get people to talk about the problems, the letter has really succeeded.
Okay, and we do want to talk about some of those problems actually in a bit more detail in a moment. In the first instance, however, I just want to look at if you like, the pros and cons in very general terms about what it is that these advances can do for us. So, Anders, can you give me a quick list of the problems from your point of view that AI might be able to help us, humanity, fix in the long or medium term?
The list is very long because AI is, after all about being able to outsource something you would need a human mind to solve. So many practical everyday problems might be worth solving using AI. For example, like recycling. It's hard to get the right kind of plastic in the right bin, but this might be the perfect job for robots, and that might be very good for the environment. Of course, it might also be that figuring out how to do carbon capture or more energy efficient use of technology or even invent entirely new technologies might be something AI might be good at. There are, of course, other applications that might be a bit more mixed blessings. The Ukraine war has demonstrated that drones are very powerful in the current military affairs, but they require drone pilots. What if you could automate that? On one hand, that might mean that fewer soldiers die in war, but it might also mean that your military power becomes proportional to the amount of computing and factories to churn out drones. But basically, everything a human can do, quite often you can do at least part of that with software, and sometimes that changes the whole equation.
Nina, what are your thoughts about some of the significant advances that we could get more in the medium term out of artificial intelligence?
Potentially new scientific breakthroughs in combating climate change and drug discovery, empowering human productivity, creativity, imagination. I mean, there are certain reports already out right now that are trying to quantify the positive effects of generative AI to the economy. I think there was one I saw the other day which said it would be 7% of GDP added by 2030 to global GDP. We know that there is going to be an immense amount of abundance. The only analogy I can draw is it's like the internet, but bigger. So a new layer of the infrastructure for human communication, information, and knowledge. And ultimately, I think this is a story about humanity, which is we are going to find ways to apply it in terrifically beneficial ways. But with the yin comes the yang, and there's absolutely no doubt that these systems and these technologies will have a dark underside to them too. But never at this scale. I don't think we've ever seen technology that is this much of an amplifier of human intent.
Mike, while we stick to the positive, what thoughts and hopes for advances do you have to add to those we've been talking about?
Well, I think what we're going to see is this technology is going to develop, and it's pretty obvious how it's going to develop. Generative AI at the moment has been mainly focused on generating text, generating what AI people call natural language, ordinary language, the kind of language that we're using now. Where this is going to go, and we've already begun to see the beginnings of this in GPT-4, which was released by OpenAI a few weeks ago, was text and images. So, for example, you would have an image and you can ask a question about the image and get meaningful answers. Where this is going to go is it's going to develop into further multimodal AI. It's going to involve sound and it's going to involve video. So, for example, you'll be able to take a video stream and have the AI generate a commentary on what's going on and be able to interpret what's going on in the video stream and answer questions about it. And it's going to connect at some point with virtual reality. The metaverse didn't quite take off in the way that Meta hoped it would. But at some point, I think it's highly likely that virtual reality will happen. And when AI meets virtual reality, then really weird things are going to happen. We're all, you know, we're going to have the potential to live in AI-generated worlds. You know, so for the example I always use, my kids are crazy about the Lord of the Rings movies. So imagine that they wear a virtual reality headset, which transforms what they see around them into basically scenes from Lord of the Rings. So they see all their teachers as orcs and all their friends as elves and so on. And each of us will be able to conjure up our own bespoke virtual reality, you know, a mashup of Star Wars and Lord of the Rings.
Mike, the next section we were going to go on to was what the problems with the AI were, and I'm not entirely sure that you haven't just described one of them from many parents' point of view. But more seriously, Anders, when we begin to think about the potential problems of AI, and we talked about that letter earlier, ChatGPT was mentioned in it. Now, what were the concerns that the writer of that letter had about ChatGPT or what we'd learned from it?
So there are both obvious near-term concerns and some deeper long-term concerns. The most obvious thing is these programs are very good at producing text that looks very plausible, but quite often is full of errors. If you try to follow a chemical recipe given by one of these programs, you will quite soon find that you're in trouble. Indeed, basing anything on facts from them can quite often be very bad, because it turns out that ChatGPT, for example, falsely accuses some people of being convicted sexual harassers. And that is just confabulated. The program is generating plausible text, and for some reason it thinks that the person is writing about might be a sexual predator, which is not true, but could have tremendously bad effects. Other deeper problems is, of course, that these systems can be used for many things. You could imagine them to falsify information, to spread misinformation. But then, on a slightly deeper level, these systems predict text. But as many postmodernists like to point out, everything is text. Genetic codes, that's a kind of text. Sequences of commands to send to your robot or in programming languages, these are all texts, and indeed these programs have been surprisingly, shockingly good at generating plausible text and sometimes helping programmers to become more productive, but also more worrying, they might be very general. They might be a form of general intelligence. People disagree profoundly about how smart they are and whether this is merely a reflection of human ingenuity seen through the training data than delivered by the program.
Well, that's very interesting. What you're saying, I mean, I know that ChatGPT has told people that I was born in Golders Green, which I wasn't. And what you're saying is the equivalent when put into, let's say, examining DNA or predicting DNA could be really catastrophic.
Yes, you really need to check against reality. And these systems right now don't have that kind of reality check. It was surprisingly easy to get it to be treacherous, which is not exactly what you want from your software. But because there is so much treachery in the literature we trained it on, it knows how to lie. This is problematic, and we need to resolve that to get something reliable and trustworthy before we put it in charge of a lot of the world.
So one of the things that points us to is the key importance of what information actually these models are trained on. Nina, you've talked very eloquently about some of the major advantages from AI. Listening to Anders there, talking, and since we're concentrating here on what the problems might be, how do you see them?
AI-generated content and information is going to become ubiquitous. It's going to absolutely inundate the information ecosystem. Then how do you know, quote unquote, what's real, what's authentic, what's synthetic? How do you navigate that? And it's not only that everything can be generated with AI, it's also the understanding that this is now possible that leads people then to not be able to trust any digital content. So for instance, a human rights abuse video may emerge out of the Xinjiang province of China. And now the CCP would have the ability to say, well, you know what? That video is not real. That's not authentic. That is AI generated.
The CCP being the Chinese Communist Party.
Correct. So the question of information integrity is absolutely fundamental going forward. Because if we can't trust the information and the content, which is pretty much the main diet that our brain is fed on, I think the average time that we spend on the internet as of 2023 per day is 7 hours. So if you can't trust the information that you engage with in this context, in this ecosystem that has become such a seminal part of life itself, then that is an existential problem, not only from a political perspective, a business perspective, but from a societal perspective.
Mike, does this bother you? And I wonder whether you could build into your answer a reference to this. I've heard it described as hallucination, the idea that, say, ChatGPT effectively creates a hallucination about something rather than a total reality about it.
Yeah. So I absolutely agree with Nina. This issue of AI generated content and the problem that it is simply not grounded in truth necessarily is a very, very big one. And actually, I think this is one of the defining problems for the technology at the moment. So these large language models that we've been talking about, ChatGPT and so on, they are not trying to tell you the truth. That's absolutely not what they're trying to do. What they're trying to do is to tell you something which sounds convincing. That's literally what the technology does. Something which sounds plausible. So the example that you gave of being born in Golders Green, it's incorrect, but it's not implausible. Actually, it sounds perfectly plausible, right? And that's the problem. If it said you'd been born in Moscow or something, that might send off some flags because that doesn't sound tremendously plausible. But the problem is the way these models are configured and the way that the fundamental technology works is geared towards producing something which sounds plausible. So that's what these hallucinations are. They get things wrong, but they get things wrong in very plausible ways. There is going to be a very big issue around misinformation in the future. So we are looking at elections in the UK next year and presidential elections in the US coming up. And I am very concerned that these tools may be used to generate misinformation on an industrial scale because they are so good at generating plausible stories. So, you know, you pick your least favorite politician and you ask one of these models to produce a story about, you know, some misbehavior of that politician. And you can just keep pressing the button and they will keep producing stories. And I'm very concerned that what we're going to be seeing on social media, you know, we've seen in the past misinformation produced by individuals and human groups. But this technology has the possibility to industrialize that. That's very concerning. And I think social media companies need to absolutely gear up to this problem and think seriously about how they're going to deal with it, because the consequences could be very serious, I think.
Right. Nina, can I shift to the question of job losses? Because this is the thing which is raised all the time by people, which is that AI is going to lead to a whole spate of middle-class job losses and so on. Is this an over-pessimistic reading of what AI capabilities will lead to?
I don't think it's an over-pessimistic reading, because I think the headline is that this epoch is one of great transformation and change, which is led by exponential technologies. We've seen that amping up in the past 30 years, and I think we're about to ratchet that up one step further. So when you look at job automation, if you consider the capabilities that have been emerging, again, only in the past kind of 5 years, these generative AI models and what they're capable of in terms of automating what seems like human creativity and intelligence in the real world application, that means that certain parts of not, you know, the factory line, but actual white collar jobs, you're talking about lawyers, you're talking about producers, you're talking about artists, you're talking about financial analysts. It seems that these systems will be good enough to automate certain parts of their job. So will there be job automation? I think absolutely there is no doubt. If you even consider how relatively new even LLMs are, and I work a lot with kind of the startup community around generative AI, and I work a lot with businesses who are actually looking at how they can already use some of these systems in their own processes and workflows. Already companies are basically figuring out how they can use ChatGPT-like services to automate customer services, to automate emails, to automate communication. So I think there's no doubt that there'll be job automation. On the flip side, there will also be new jobs created. So it's not only that there's a finite number of jobs and AI is going to take them, but also when this is the time to start considering and debating some of these really profound philosophical questions. So if one agrees that a lot of productivity and abundance at least has the potential to be unleashed by these models and these systems in their real world application, then it's also time to have the big debate about questions like UBI, meaning universal basic income, the idea that everybody should have a kind of basic income provided by the state.
I want to get a view from all of you on one particular aspect of the letter we've been talking about earlier. And it asks this question: should we develop non-human minds that might eventually outnumber, outsmart, obsolete and replace us. Should we risk loss of control of our civilization? That's the question it asks. And that sounds like something out of an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie and so on. But I want to get your views on whether or not that represents any kind of reality. Mike, what do you think?
So I thought the letter was problematic in some respects. I think it conflated, as Anders talked about earlier on, it conflated some near-term issues, which are very real. They're immediate. I mean, the issues of misinformation that we've been talking about, this is something which is going to affect us very, very soon. Issues of bias, which are very real for many people in the world, the problem that this technology might be biased, and conflating those with much more speculative long-term concerns. So the Terminator scenario, I mean, I have to say, you know, until about sort of 7 or 8 years ago, the Terminator scenarios were absolutely not taken seriously in AI at all. And I think a lot of AI researchers were very surprised when people started to seriously ask, you know, could this kind of thing actually happen? I think my perspective is I have not yet heard any plausible scenario via which the Terminator scenario could come about.
Mike, just to be clear, the Terminator scenario that people talk about, that's the one essentially where computers take over the world, they go rogue on us.
Yeah, so there's a very popular idea, the idea of the singularity, and it goes like this. At some point in the future, machines will be as clever as us. And then what they might do is apply their cleverness to making them even cleverer, improve their programs. And then once they're cleverer, they can apply their cleverer selves to making themselves even cleverer. And at that point, it's out of our control. And that kind of is, roughly speaking, the Terminator scenario. And, you know, it's the plot of endless sci-fi novels and movies and so on. But I say nobody's ever actually come out, to my mind, with a plausible scenario, a genuinely plausible scenario, how that actually might happen.
Anders, do you entirely agree with that? And if you don't, could you give us a brief set of reasons why you don't?
Yeah, I do disagree. I think it's important not to lose sight of long-term dangers just because we are not certain about it. Even if it was a low probability of something very dangerous happening, we might want to do something about it. Nobody would get onto an airplane if they were told, oh yes, it's 10% risk that it crashes. And indeed, when I was hanging out with technologies and AI researchers in Silicon Valley, they were kind of saying, yeah, maybe it's 10% risk that we get a civilizational collapse because of this. And then they happily went on programming. I think AI is already being used to generate AI in the sense that people are optimizing methods of developing AI. People are working on AI tools for improving programming, which gets applied to AI. Right now, this is, of course, being done by having human programmers adding judgment and cleverness. But I think we should see more and more automation of this happening. Does that lead to a singularity? Nobody really knows. We actually don't have a good theory for these kinds of things. And that should be a reason for, you know, caution rather than saying, yeah, it's probably not a problem.
Nina, it's a program in and of itself, what you might actually do to regulate all this. But are there practical steps that you can see in the short and medium term, which we could try and take to try and mitigate some of the effects that you've been talking about earlier, negative effects of AI?
Absolutely. And I think the fundamental starting place is the understanding, when you consider how profound the implications are, that this isn't a job for a single government or a regulatory agency. This is a society-wide practice, which is why the AI moratorium letter, which I also find problematic in many ways, because I think concentrating on so-called AGI or the robots taking over the world scenario right now is actually causing us to take our eye off the ball. If that letter achieved anything, it was good at raising this into an issue of public consciousness, because we absolutely need to be having the debate. But I think the harder thing is going to be, how does society adapt to this? You know, how do we rethink education? How do we rethink our legal systems? How do we rethink our regulatory frameworks? Because again, this is all so universal and profound that I think our kind of analog systems are almost out of date. We need to have a fundamental reconceptualization and a reset to understand the exponential changes that are ahead of us, and then slowly decide what kind of society we want to build. And I agree with Mike. I don't think this is AGI. I don't think the robots are taking over, although that is theoretically possible at some point in the future. We have the agency, and we also need to understand who controls these systems and to what end. Because whoever does is going to have an enormous amount of wealth, money, and influence.
Nina Schick there with Michael Wooldridge and Anders Sandberg. My thanks to them. And my conclusion is we're all going to need to get our heads around this, if not for our own sakes, but for the sakes of those who follow us. We at The Briefing Room will be back at the same time next week. Or will it be us? You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Isabel Goff. The editor was Richard Varden. And the programme was mixed by James Beard and Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. But if you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and listen to the entire back catalogue, including the one asking who's afraid of the Wagner Group, the one about Trump's legal woes, and the one on the threat posed by avian flu.
I hear sobbing, and I absolutely knew that nobody else was in the house.
Uncanny is back.
The on-duty flight lieutenant came in white as a sheet, and he said, "It's back."
Season 2, featuring brand new stories of real-life encounters with the supernatural.
I had never been so scared in my life. I don't believe in ghosts, but I believe in what was in that house.
Subscribe on BBC Sounds if you dare.
Wofür machen heimische Frösche Freudensprünge? Für Mineralwasser von Bad Liebenwerda. Natürlich aus dem Naturpark Niederlausitzer Heidelandschaft. Erhältlich in Naturell, sanft, medium und spritzig. Bad Liebenwerder. Von Natur aus liebenswerter.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.